Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
So listen, how's your Christmas shopping going? You haven't started yet, have you? Well, fear not, the big interview is here to help solve all your problems. For the football fans in your life, here's three stocking fillers. Firstly, the documentary film of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World, is now available everywhere on DVD and digital download. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball is the definitive story, we like to say, of the greatest football team ever assembled and features exclusive interviews with Barca's stellar cast of current and ex-players, including that geezer Lionel Messi, Xavi, Andres Iniesta, Thierry Henry, Dani Alves, Gerard Piqué, Carlos Puyol and Sergio Busquets, plus a rare exclusive contribution from Pep Guardiola himself. There, that's that one present sorted. Secondly, my old chum and fellow dandy, Jonathan Northcroft, has a new book out published by Backpage, these marvellous people that bring you the books, the podcasts. It's called Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, and it's Jonathan's World Cup diary from Russia last summer, and it's essential reading for the football fan in your life. Finally, check out another Backpage book, Football 2.0, How the World's Best Play the Modern Game by Grant Wall. Through extensive interviews with one player in every key position on and off the pitch, Grant breaks down the technical and tactical revolutions which have transformed football. So, there you have it. Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, Football 2.0. That's not only difficult to say, it's Christmas sorted. Courtesy of your friends at the big interview. You're ho, ho, ho. Welcome. You're about to listen to an interview which our socios enjoyed in full 12 months ago. If you'd like to listen to these exclusive monthly big interviews on the day that they're released, it's time to join us. That means supporting us. It means the price of a pint per month. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Go now, join and become a socio. That means you'll get that extra big interview every month. And you'll also unlock our entire archive straight away. All for £2.99 a month. It's the best deal in town, baby. And we need you. It's Super Kevin Phillips, Sunderland legend. I was thrilled to listen to him describe his thought process in front of goal, plus his explanation of the art of finishing, which includes a wonderful quote from the great Jimmy Greaves. Kevin also breaks down his phenomenal partnership with Niall Quinn, that rivalry fierce with Alan Shearer, plus the unique challenges he faced when trying to coach a certain James Vardy at Leicester. Deep breaths, Kev, deep breaths. Our guest takes us back to his younger days playing right back at non-league Baldock Town, and it's a far cry from the experiences of academy players today. Kevin gives us his firm views on that too. I have to ask you a little bit about, rather than just saying about you and Niall and the enjoyment that you had there, but what was the process at Sunderland? Because I think a lot of people have got the mental picture a little bit wrong retrospectively. It was nowhere near a long ball team. I think you fed well off wides. But let's say, in those glorious seasons getting promoted and that first season, seventh at Sunderland, when the ball is at the back, was there a team system that you kind of know, you know, ball dance and it'll go from here, it'll go from here. Peter and Bobby had certain rules and... Yeah. everybody knew the moving parts? Or was it just like, if you give it to Niall and Kevin, they'll sort it out, you know?
No, it wasn't. I think everyone, you know, I've got that perception of, you know, just whack it up to Quinn, he'll flick it on and I'll run on and score. And there was many games when that did happen, but, you know, we had a lot more to our game than that. You know, we had two wingers in Nicky Summerby and Alan Johnson. Nicky Summerby, for me, was one of the best crossers I've ever seen.
Really?
And I trained with David Beckham and played with him in England. Gosh, yeah. And David, you know, don't by far was the best crosser of the ball I have. But Nicky Summerby wasn't a million miles away from him. And what Nicky had the art of doing was he didn't have to take a fullback on to get the ball in the box. If you stood off him a yard, he would whip it in between the fullback or the centre half. If you cut that one off and showed him outside, he had the ability of just knocking it sideways and then whipping his foot round the back of the defence. It was just, it was for me and Quinny, it was amazing to play. He very rarely really got to the byline like an old winger would and then clip it up to come in. That never really happened.
It feels like that's very underappreciated.
Well, we appreciate it. And for now, whenever I do, you know, that's why I talk about it. And whenever I go to Sunderland and talk about Sunderland players, I always say Nicky Summerby, for me, was one of the best crossers of the balls I've seen.
And this interests me now then. Who's the boss in this relationship? Do you say to him or to Alan, Nicky, this is how and when I want it? Or do they give it as they can and you learn the latter?
Yeah, the latter for me.
Why?
Because I could read his body language about when he was, you know, because we work together so closely, we'll have that relationship on the training ground. I can tell when he's going to deliver the ball. And there's no point me going early because the way he delivers a ball, I'll end up offside. I know that he puts so much whip and curl on it that I can...
You can hold your run just a little bit and you're going to be coming onto it.
And like we said earlier, then my process comes in, right, how do I beat my defender? Now it is movement, get out of his eye line. So when he has a little look, then he looks back. Hopefully that ball's coming in, then bang, I'm in behind him.
Do you know when you say it like that? It's even,
well, it seems simple,
even, no, but even listen to it. Do you know what? Not simple, it sounds sweet.
Yeah, well, it's, it, you know, it's...
It, when you get the mechanics of anything,
of course,
it's like why engineering's good. If you open anything up and show how it works, it looks all the more beautiful.
Yeah.
A colleague of yours from those days, Kev Coban.
Yeah, Chile, yeah.
He said, Kevin, the best finisher cutting in from the inside left channel on the training ground, he used to be 10 from 10 from that area, outside the area. Incredible at finding the corner with precision and power.
Well, I think it, you know, it's nice words from Kev, and, you know, he was fantastic for us. But it was like what I said earlier, you know, my thought process about the Jimmy Greaves thing. The Jimmy Greaves, pass it into the net, pass it into the net. And, you know, in training, that's all I ever tried to do. I very rarely smashed it. And, you know, as I say, good practice, good habits, you take it into the game.
Was Niall made for you, or did you both said individually that you didn't actually work phenomenally hard at choreographing it, but it has to be a product of mutual intelligence.
Yeah, of course. It's, you know, Niall's an intelligent guy, and, you know, you don't go on to do what he's done unless you've got some intelligence about you. First and foremost, what a footballer he was. Mm. You know, with his feet, his intelligence, his ability to hang in the air and look while he was in the air to see where I was and then focus on the ball again. And then it was just quite remarkable.
You've just done a really good impersonation of him there.
It was funny.
How, like, you moved your neck and it's kind of like assessing everything around.
It was. And, you know, Peter Crouch has had the similar thing when I had a season with Peter at Southampton, and he, for me, was equally as good with his feet and in the air as well. He had that ability jump, have a look, and then where's my partner? And nod it. It's just something that their gift that they had. So we were made for each other, and it made it all the more easier for me to work off Big Noel, because, you know, he knew where I was running and he was able to put the ball where I was running.
Without telling tales, to what extent is it, because that squad had the right good social life. Yeah. Peter Reid likes a night out.
That's first putting time it mildly.
I was deliberately putting it quite mildly. The first time I ever met him, he was playing on the sly. He was at Everton, somebody at Marbella, some Serbian just bought Marbella Football Club. And him and Kerry Dixon, and we, is it Terry Phelan who used to play at Wimbledon and Man City?
Yeah, yeah.
They came down and played as unregistered guests for Marbella against Crystal Palace.
Right.
And we sort of tagged along a little bit, my mate and I. We were in Marbella at the time, end of season, May, June. And we saw, first time we saw what a proper Premier League night out was like. And did you live in an area where it was quite forgiving, that if the team was playing well, you can get out as a group?
Yeah.
And do the kind of things that, you know, that phrase about a team that drinks together, stays together, plays together, all that kind of stuff. That's true of that era.
Yeah, 100%. You know, we had it in abundance. Certainly wouldn't recommend it now, of course. But that was an era when, you know, Peter, for me, when people say, I played under 20, 21 managers.
That's all.
And people say, you know, who's the best manager you've ever had? And it's quite easy to say Peter E, because that was the best time of my career. But he really was. You know, in terms of tactics and that, it wasn't his strongest point. That was more Bobby Saxton. He knew the game, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, of course you did.
But
yeah,
his man management skills were excellent.
Which you'd pay $1 million for if you can get that in any dressing room, man management.
Yeah, 100%. It's more about that nowadays than ever. But then, you know, he had the art of dealing with problems, getting the best out of players, and giving the lads that leeway to go and enjoy himself. But he had that command and that respect that the players wouldn't take the piss. So, and we respected that. But one of the biggest things were, you know, you can play hard, but if you don't work hard, then we've got an issue with you. So he demanded it on the training ground, he demanded it in games. And if he did that, he had no issues with you enjoying yourselves off the pitch.
You know, I know what you're saying now, and I would be hypocritical if I didn't say that in the modern era. You can see why that's got to be edged up. Yeah. But presumably one of the things that we've learned most in these interviews is that the camaraderie, one of the things you miss about football most is the humour and the digging and and really noising each other up, or I suppose just the laughs that you have. And you have that in the dressing room anyway, because you have to be quick to survive in the pranks. But also, if you transfer that out and draw it out for another few hours in the pub, then it is a bonding thing. And like, I know this guy will be there for me because we've shared X. No?
Oh, definitely, yeah, definitely. It's, you know, you get to know, it's famous, isn't it? You get to know people better when you have a drink. Socially, you go out, you have a drink, you relax a bit more. You ask probably more personal questions when you're out than you would in the dressing room. So you ask them a bit more about their lifestyle, the way they were brought up, about their parents, this and that. So you know a bit more about the player than you know more about me.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that helps. Yeah. You know, nowadays I see, you know, one player, you can guarantee, even in our dressing room, one player probably won't even know if he's got a brother or sister.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way football's gone, and whether it's right or wrong. But then it was what worked for us. You know, we were comfortable doing it.
Is there a thing in dressing rooms where, irrespective just about your personality, asking things like that, players are worried too. There was a nice anecdote from Chris Waddle way back when he's the second most expensive player ever. He goes to Marseille and he's been told to drive in with a Brazilian every day and they can't speak each other languages. And gradually they just go, and one of them goes, Gordon Banks, and he goes, Pelé. And all the trip is only great Brazilians and great.
Yeah.
And at 6-7 months in, when Chris has become adored and he's successful, one of the French guys leans over and says, listen, there's a dinner next week. And Chris goes, I've been here 7 months, you've not spoken to me in English. What? And I've been stuck. Yeah. Why not? He said, I was embarrassed. That thing about being embarrassed, like that thing about knowing if you've got a brother or sister or a personal problem. Yeah. In a dressing room, I don't think the atmosphere is they ask things like that. You don't show any weaknesses. People are sometimes quiet because they're scared of being picked on, no?
Yeah, definitely. I was totally changed. Totally changed. And back then, nobody had any issues. You know, everyone knew everything about everyone.
Really?
And the banter, sometimes it got a bit near the mark. But what I liked about that, it got dealt with in the dressing room. You know, it didn't get... Unfortunately, we live in an era now with social media. We didn't have it then, but... You know, it was dealt, lock the door, you know, you deal with it there. You know, you just get on with it. And as soon as that door opened, the air's clear and you crack on, you get on with it. So it's totally...
It's true, isn't it? But it's risky.
It is risky. Yeah, it was risky, but,
Can it still exist exactly the same, do you think?
I still feel there's a place for locking the dressing room door and ironing out your problems. Now, I take the Darren Gibson incident last week, you know, that should have been sorted out behind closed doors.
Critical words to say about players, but he shared it after a couple of drinks with fans.
Exactly, and, you know, it's, don't get me wrong, when we were out and about then, of course fans would interact with you and you might have your little moan about so-and-so, but you knew you weren't getting recorded.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it needs to be dealt with in the dressing room, and perhaps not enough of that's done nowadays. And I think if it was, you know, we'd probably be a better place.
This definitely isn't a social media thing, but I'm making a film right now of my first book with Duncan McMath, who's not listening live, obviously, but he's in Barcelona. And he was in O'Neill's one night and in Durham, and he's a mad Tottenham fan.
Okay.
Now, he alleges
that he made conversation with you and you were charm personified and you chatted away and he begged you to come to Tottenham. And he reckons you told him that it had been quite close.
It had, yeah.
True or false? Duncan McMathews is your moment?
Yes, it was. I actually was on holiday in Dubai with my wife and my first daughter. And I got friendly with Justin Edinburgh, David Kerslake and Colin Calderwood. They were in the same hotel. So they said, come over and join us for a drink. So I'm chatting, you know, having a chat. And they said, oh, we'd love to see you down at Spurs. And I said, well, I said, funny enough, you know, there is a bit of rumours around that I could. They said, right, leave it with us. And John Gorman was in the hotel next door. He was assistant manager to Glenn Hoddle at the time. So they got John across. And John says, oh, right, there's a bit of. He said, I'll get Glenn on. So got Glenn on the phone. And I spoke to Glenn. And Glenn said, yeah, I'd love to have you at Tottenham.
Good choice.
So I said, well, you know, all my family were Tottenham and I was Arsenal. My dad was a massive Tottenham fan.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're all huge Tottenham. My uncles now are all Tottenham. They still go. So we had a conversation on the phone. I said, yeah, you know, it would be like a dream come true to go and play for a club, you know, where my dad supported him.
Yeah, very emotional, actually.
My mum. I said, yeah, I'd love it. He said, well, you know, leave it to me and we'll come back to you. Unfortunately, I had to go for, when I came back off my holiday, I was going in for a hernia operation. And Glenn got wind of that, because he'd made some phone calls. And he rang me back and he said, I understand you've got to have a hernia operation. I went, yeah. He said, well, I've spoken to Daniel Levy. And he said, he ain't going to pay what we probably need to pay for you. And I think I was 28 or 29 at the time. He said, for someone at your age who needs a hernia operation, because hernias back then weren't what they're like now.
Things have changed, yeah.
So Glenn said to me, listen, he says, I know someone in the south of France that can cure your hernia without an operation. Because Glenn was very much into the faith healing. He said, we'd like to send you. I said, well, Glenn, I can't.
Isn't the water therapy, is it?
I don't know. He just said, we know people that can cure.
I think I know. I think Tony Adams went
there.
I said, Glenn,
it's all well and good. I said, but I'm a Sunderland player. I can't sod off to the south of France and have my hernia cured by another club. I said, if we're going to do it, let's do the right process.
Yeah.
He said, okay, we'll come back. And eventually, because of my hernia, it stopped me going from Tottenham, which would have been great. But, you know, on the flip side of that, I had a wonderful time at Sunderland. And in hindsight, yeah, it would have been lovely to play for Tottenham, but my 6 years there, I couldn't swap it for anything.
As soon as you mentioned Glenn, he's indelibly associated with the England job. If I try and pull two themes together and say to you the word Wembley, whether club or country, if Wembley starts the adrenaline and the synapses going, what does Wembley mean to you if you roll it all up into a ball? Because you've had a full mix of experiences.
Yeah, it means growing. Oh, I remember watching the FA Cup, as you would have done as a youngster, watching the team bus from 12 o'clock, travel the helicopters above going to Wembley. It got my juices flowing when I was a young kid, Wembley Way. The finals, watching the finals. I managed to go to a Milk Cup final when I was very young. I can't remember. I think it would have been Arsenal against maybe Liverpool.
Charlie Nicholas scoring.
Yeah, that was it.
I think it was Charlie Nicholas.
I don't remember an awful lot about the game because I was young. But when I first went. And then, believe it or not, my sister played a fair bit of football for Hemel Hempstead Ladies. And she managed to get to a cup final, which was played at Wembley.
And thankfully she's never teased you about it.
Well,
right?
You know, I didn't want to go to the game because I was gutted that she played at Wembley before me. And she's never let me forget it. But I went along and watched. And
Please, can we name your sister? Just out of
Karen, yeah, Karen.
Karen, she's, good job. Did they win?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
Let's say yes.
Let's say yes. Yeah. Don't want to spoil
it. Go on, Hemel.
But I just remember, again, when I went to Highbury about going up the steps, the Milk Cup final, and then you come up and you see Wembley, the green turf, the crowd. It was just, I want to play.
And this is Twin Towers Wembley,
yeah,
of course.
Twin Towers, yeah, the Wembley.
Yeah.
I want to play her at some stage. And I was gutted, Mrs. I was delighted for her, don't get me wrong, but I was gutted that she'd played there before me. And, you know, I couldn't wait to get my opportunity to go and play there.
But then it has to bring in the feelings of the first time I ever saw you. We wouldn't call it met, but I remember speaking to you. I remember being, again, like I say, I'm soppy about people's stories in football. I remember in Burnham Beeches, you've been called up for England. That was where the get together was. I'm not sure it's where the hotel was, or was it?
Yeah, Burnham Beeches. Yeah, we stayed there,
and we go there to the to the get-together, and it was a nice place, and there was a bridge club that we used to listen to all the press conferences really nearby. And you were there, and you shouldn't be floating on a cloud of happiness. Mm-hmm. You'd had an incident personally with your daughter, who was well again, but there'd been a little fright. You're picked by your country. I'm pretty sure you'd just come up from the championship. It was the championship year, the first division year.
Yeah, it's when we got promoted, yes.
Sunderland player in there as well, with Mickey Gray, who's also in there. Yeah. So two of you in there. And I just remember this kind of... You were just beaming.
Well, because it was a dream come true. It was a dream come true. I was like any other kid growing up in the street. You know, everyone, when you scored a goal, and I remember scoring a goal just against the fence at the back of my house. As soon as I'd scored, I'd go, Gary Lineker, and run off with my hand in the air. Grew up watching, the World Cup where Lineker scores his hat trick. I remember being allowed to stay up to watch it, laying on the carpet with my hands, in my head in my hands, watching the TV.
Against Poland this
year. Against Poland,
They've got a win to go through.
I wanted to play for England. First and foremost, I wanted to be a professional footballer. Secondly, I wanted to represent my country. And, luckily I've been able to do both. But you're right, if I hadn't have been floating on air down there, there would have been something wrong with me. So, when I did get that phone call, me and Mickey, to say we'd been picked, it was incredible. And my actual getting picked for England was caught on camera, because I was doing a camera shoot stroke. Sky were following me for Deodora down on the beachfront at Sunderland.
All right.
And before I left to go and do it, Reedy said, keep your phone on, because there might be a shout of you being in the England squad. And I'm like, yeah, no chance. So while we're doing the interview and the photo shoot, my phone rings. And I said to the guys, listen, I've got to answer this. I said, because it's the gaffer. And they said, yeah, no problem. And they actually was filming. They just kept the cameras rolling. Kev, it's Reedy. You've been picked for England. Well done. Absolute delight for you and Mickey. And I was just like, I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. The goosebumps had come down me. Brilliant. I was nervous. I was shaking. And I couldn't wait to get home, tell my wife and ring my family. And it was a surreal moment to say I've actually been picked for my country. One, country. Two, I'm still a championship player. And me and Mickey, I think, were the first two to be picked for England out of the championship. So it was amazing.
And it's Keegan, who presumably you haven't seen so much of as a kid.
Yeah, not an awful lot. Obviously, know a lot
but
about him.
When it happened at the time, because Kevin had been brought in, and as a Scot, now certainly not anti-English, but as a youngster, when you're brought up, particularly if England are winning all the time, he's weren't particularly popular on my side of the border.
Yeah, no.
And Kevin would torture us all the time. So until you meet him and see his charms, he was difficult to admire as a Scot. As you meet him, and you hear the passion, and then when you see his achievements, because he was an exciting footballer, powerful footballer, I immediately wondered if he'd seen something of himself in you. Did you see anything like that in him, or did he see anything like that in you?
Yeah, he did, and I think there's been a couple of quotes, from what he said and from what I've read, that he did see, a bit of himself in me, which was a great compliment for me. You're right, he was fantastic to me. Absolutely brilliant, not just to me, but to Mickey. But the advice and the one-on-one stuff that he give us in terms of staying after training with finishing, staying behind with Shearer, Owen, Fowler, just learning off of these guys, and then Kevin giving us a little bit of tuition, talking to us. He was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I can't speak highly enough of him, giving him my opportunity to play for
in
my
Hungary,
country.
In Hungary, didn't it? You start in Hungary?
Yeah, Hungary. So, we met at Burnham Beaches, then we travelled out to Hungary, and... part of me wish it would have been at Wembley, my debut, but to pull on that free line shirt away at Hungary alongside Alan and many other good players was a dream come true.
What's the story with Alan? Because you think you're much more practical than me, but that kismet, that fate of, he's just a little bit older and ahead of you at Southampton, and famously, as apprentices should do, you're given tasks, which now doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I need to ask you about that. But he's one of the sets of boots you're cleaning.
Mm.
You've done him at Newcastle in the Sunderland Newcastle thing. If you're going to be an England striker, you've either got to partner him or beat him. what do you get on? Did he help? Was he a rival who spurred you on because he was in your way?
I anticipated a little bit of rivalry amongst us when we met up within the England squad. And, he did what he had to do within the camp. He helped us. But part of me probably felt he could have helped us a little bit more.
I would say from my point of view, from having met him and watched him, I think he's a very remorseless, very tough guy. And I say that because I think it's accurate, not because it's a criticism. It's what's made him successful.
Well, he was, you know, I think he's, as all top players, I think they've got that selfishness about them. Perhaps it's about me more than the team a little bit. I mean, I remember we partnered each other against Belgium at the Stadium of Light. And obviously there was a lot made because it was at the Stadium of Light of myself. And
Frank Lampard with a debut.
Yeah, that was his debut. Yeah, it was his debut. Oh, you make me feel old now.
Listen, how do you think I feel? Yeah. And I also noticed that whenever you talked about defenders slow on the turn, you looked up at me and I said, how we're feeling at this stage is not part of the equation.
But Kevin started me in that game and I played alongside Alan. And I think there was a part of Alan, because it was at the Stadium of Light and it was majority Sunderland supporters, I just felt within the game there were times he probably could have passed to me and he looked somewhere else. Now, he might totally disagree with that, but, you know, I'm only saying from what I felt. But he scored a wonderful goal that game. I think it was sort of like an overhead kick, wasn't it?
He tended to score.
There's no doubt, and he's the
best. Because all we're saying, I just found it interesting that he's not always been in the way, but I like what football does. Football weaves these stories where characters come across each other all the time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you got Wembley is where I don't want to let go. And nor do I want to let go of apprenticeship. So we'll wind down now, Kevin, because you said that you had time for us. But I've talked your hind legs off.
No, it's fine. I've enjoyed it.
When I was being taught the most I've probably learned as a journalist, it was probably in the 4 years that Guardiola was at Barcelona, because we were given access and the players would talk. And also, it was a fierce, hot environment. If you didn't learn something there as a journalist, then you shouldn't have been in the game. So I watched him closely, and I watched him at the end of last season because people have high expectations of him at City. And I try to see if I can understand, because I'm not living in the same city as him anymore, so I try to understand a lot from the long chunks of press conferences you get that are unedited. And he doesn't always like answering the questions that he's given in any country. He likes to talk about pure football. And I thought he was really revealing in May when he said he was asked about which academy players were going to break through. Because there's this desire that if you've got Guardiola, there'll be a magic wand, that there'll be a Xavi or an Iniesta or a Messi coming through, even though their development was nothing to do with him.
Right.
Their coronation was to do with him once he inherited them as a coach. Yeah, yeah. And he said really clearly, he said they're talented, but they're uncompetitive. Right. Because the league that they're in, he said, there's no crowd. It doesn't matter if they win or lose. Yeah. Their talent lies there. But they're not, the gap between what they are and what they need to be in my first team is too big. So he's criticising that equivalent of the apprentice system. Mm-hmm. Now, we talked at huge length about this with Damien Duff and about how he was treated at Blackburn and how brutally tough it was. And we were quoting what Gary Neville and Phil Neville had said about life as the class of 92 at Manchester United, which is famously tough. Mm-hmm. Have we got things wrong? You know, if I go back to you cleaning boots at Southampton and being told I presumably to clean the terraces, clean the showers, I don't know what else, possibly being bullied. Certainly Damien was hard on the...
That happened to me under Dave Merritton as an apprentice. And you're right, you know, at times you didn't say anything, but it stood you in good stead. Well, it certainly stood me in good stead for where I am now. And you're right, you couldn't get away with the sort of stuff that the coaches did then. And I mean in terms of the way they spoke to you, mm-hmm. what they made you do in terms of cleaning. You know, I remember we'd, at the end of the day, big Dave Merritt and strapping 6'3", Geordie, powerful, intimidating guy, would run his finger across the top of a doorway, which I couldn't even reach on a pair of step ladders. And he'd get a bit of dust. And if he saw dust, he'd go, he'd make everyone strip back onto their kit, out onto the running track and run. And at the time, you'd be like, oh, God, well, it's just a bit. But it was standards, setting standards. So you're right, we've veered away from that. The thing that we're not allowed to clean boots now, for me, is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's a part of growing up.
Is it banned now? You can't ask them to do it? Or it's just not the done thing?
It's not the done thing, yeah. It's not the done thing. It, you know, I have my own views on the academy system in terms of, you know, they start so young now. I think they start under six, certainly start here at under six. Mm. But in terms of, you know, the apprentices or stroke these scholars now, first team, first year pros, why couldn't we send them out into a warehouse for 2 weeks? Mm. Why not?
Real life.
Real life. I had to. I worked in a warehouse for 12 hours a day when I was in non-league.
Yeah.
And it made me see life from the other side. And it makes you appreciate what you've got there and then.
Yeah.
So why can't we send our 18-year-old into a warehouse and get him up at 6 in the morning, put him on a 12-hour shift, get him home at 6 at night, and then go and make him train on the Tuesday night for 2 hours? Get him doing that. Now, I'm not saying that would cure any of our problems, but it would certainly make a grounding of our young pros appreciate what they've got.
Because we're both talking about the system, but you just finished on young pros. As much as we'll criticise the young pros who are milksops or who waste their money or don't appreciate their chance or flash cars, how do they actually know any better unless they've got parents to teach them or that kind of experience to show them? You're not born savvy.
No.
And if you never give them that experience, then how are they supposed to be a little bit more appreciative of their privileges? Yeah. You know, I think we're doing them a disservice.
And also, you know, and I work here at a fantastic football club, and you know, if you've got to walk around the facilities here, they get given that from like under six, and if they're good enough and they come through the whole system, they know nothing different from training on Deso pitches, jacuzzi, swimming pools. You know, is that giving them the right kind of grounding? Now, you know, that's not Derby's fault, that's not the kids' fault, but...
No, in an ideal world, it's right. I mean, you're saying to them, we value you.
Of course,
we're going to take the best care of you. But if there's supposed to be a yin and yang in life, we haven't given them the other part,
exactly,
have we?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So then, for me, there needs to be a part of that. You know, another one of my theories or crazy theories is, in terms of when these young lads do get rewarded with these massive contracts, why can't we have a system in place? Now, I understand it would take every chairman of every football club to agree to it. You know, up to 21, if you're on 60 grand a week at 20-year-old, why can't you only give them 20 grand a week and put 40 into a trust till they're 21, till they're 22? Now, I know where the issues lie with that. You know, if I'm signing for A and they say, well, if you're going to do that, Team B is going to give us all that 60.
We'll lump it all on
straight
you.
Away, so we're going to go there. So it would take the whole league of chairmen, et cetera, to all agree to that. And if we could put something like that in a place, you know, if a kid can't live on 20 grand a week, a 20-year-old, then
there's
something wrong. You know, so why give them that 60 grand? We'll create our own problems. But unfortunately, that's the way we are.
Is there a debate going on? Can we try and wrestle this back via the PFA, the Premier League?
Well, I've said it for ages. You know, whenever I get asked, we get asked, people always say, you know, what's the problem? Why are we not producing young players? Why is England not going on to do this and that? You know, it stems from a young age. You know, if we can put things in place to try and help these young players moving forward, then surely we've got to look at that.
Well, now let me ask you, as we close, about the Leicester stage. Because you were there when you chose to stop. And I aren't hugely surprised that you still have that lingering feeling that if I really put my mind to it, I could probably still play professional football. And I think, to be honest with you, that I trust that instinct. Mm-hmm. But it's there that you say, stop. And I think it's good in many ways in that that must have been blinding to take them up, one. And then, I mean, I live in Barcelona, so I could only watch as a witness from a distance, staying up.
Mm-hmm.
in that first season. It was kind of miraculous. What has Leicester been for you in that season of coming up and staying up? What were the things, the incidents, the turning points, the happy memories, the things you did that made a difference in that sort of two-season period before you started coaching?
Well, it was, you know, my time at Leicester was a massive roller coaster. It set me on my path to my coaching career to today in terms of Nigel Pearson offering me a coaching role at the end of the season that we got promoted. I made the decision to retire at the end of that season. I felt that it was the right time in terms of because I'd been offered a coaching role. In actual fact, Nigel wanted me to be a player coach. He said, I have no problems. If you want to carry on playing, I'll give you another year in the Premier League. And in hindsight now, I wish I had have done that. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I didn't do it because I didn't want to do another pre-season. But I ended up doing the pre-season anyway because I had to make numbers up. So, you know, I thought, yeah, at some point I've got to bring my career to an end. And I thought it was the perfect opportunity, promotion, walking into a coaching job in the Premier League. So that we report back that season and everyone's on a high. You know, the mentality is, you know, we want to go and put ourselves against the best players in the world. So we don't get off to the best start. You know, and I think we spent hours, me, Nigel, Craig Shakespeare, Steve Walsh, Mike Stowell, the coaching staff, trying to pick a system, pick a team week in and week out to try and beat the team that we were playing on the Saturday. And I felt that we probably lost focus of what got us promoted the season before. The system with Vardy, Nugent up front, Drinkwater, James, Schlupp, Mahrez, you know, almost the same team. Not a million miles that went on to win the Premier League.
Very close.
So I think we try to pick a team to try and beat a Premier League team instead of probably saying that this is what got us promoted. Let's work on making ourselves even better with that system.
Let them cope with us.
Yeah, let them cope with us. So I think that's probably where we got it wrong. And it came a point where I think a lot of people had given up on us. It was tough. You know, when you're bottom of the Premier League and you're getting beat week in and week out, being in and around a training ground is awful. I've been relegated from the Premier League as a player 3 times, so I know exactly what it's like to be in a dressing room when things ain't going right. Mm. You know, just being around the area, it was very down. You know, confidence was very low.
It's contagious, that, isn't it?
Oh, it's massive. It's massive. Not just within the club, but the whole city.
Yeah.
Wherever you go,
you can't turn. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, you know, something had to happen. We had to try and come up with a solution, come up with a system. And I wouldn't say we stumbled across it, but we just, in the end, we went with the five at the back, really. We went with the
three wing backs.
Yeah. And we went for the Jeff Schlupp as a left wing back and Mark Albrighton as a right wing back. Now, Mark Albrighton predominantly is a winger.
Yeah.
But his work rate and his energy allowed him to get up and down the pitch, same as Jeff Schlupp. And we had Vasilevsky, Morgan and Hoof as our three centre-halves, who were big, you know, strapping lads. And we thought, right, we've got to have a go. We want to get two strikers on the pitch because we need to score goals. So we had Vardy and Nugent. And it just happened. It just clicked. Played a game, we win, we started winning. And all of a sudden, people are going, hold on a minute. Leicester are starting to win football matches. They may have an opportunity here of staying up. And it was incredible. The atmosphere just turned round like that. Although we were still, you know, rooted to the bottom of the Premier League, we started winning football matches and all of a sudden you could sense within the dressing room and the training ground that we've got a chance here. If we can keep these lads fit and we can work with them day in and day out and get them better, we'll have an opportunity of staying up. And when it came to the point where we had to, funny enough, go to Sunderland to get a point to stay in the Premier League, it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. And I think we still had 2 games left after that. We got up there, we get a point and we survived. And for me, it's better than Brian Robson with West Brom the year they did it, because we were at the bottom of the Premier League pretty much.
It shouldn't have been possible.
Yeah, from day one. And it was just incredible.
The adrenaline must have been fantastic. And then the things that we talked about at Sunderland, that feeling of bonding, that, like, thou shalt not pass, we're in this together, that's the kind of thing that if you could bottle, you could sell, you'd be a billionaire.
Oh, 100%. And for me, that is one of the reasons why Leicester won the Premier League. And I know for a fact, because I went down there many times and I spoke to a lot of them, they managed themselves in that dressing room. Although Ranieri did his bit and Craig Shakespeare in the background did an awful lot, ultimately those players got hold of each other. They would lock the door, because I was there for the first 2 months. there was times when they would lock the door and have it out amongst themselves, lock it out, they'd come out, we'd be waiting, you know, set up on the training pitch. How'd it go? Yeah, it went well, and that was it. We didn't ask anything else. And you could tell that their team spirit, their togetherness, carried on from the season before.
I'm an ambassador for the Dorothy Goodman School, where they take handicapped kids and give them, they aim high, they give them aspirations, they teach them, they show them what they can still achieve, and everybody there is mad on Leicester. And Liam Deasy, who's so involved in fundraising there, asked me to ask you, because he adores you. Liam, I can say that out loud, can't I? Ask Kevin about the Zimmer celebration at Bournemouth. Kevin made such a huge difference that champion season. One of those true professionals who had so much time for fans. When he talked to the young kids, they listened intently, despite probably not knowing previously what he'd achieved. So, the Zimmer celebration? I don't remember seeing it.
Yeah, well, it was, as you get a bit older, what was I, 40 at the time? And you get a little bit, you can hear people in the crowd, you know, when you're warming up, oh, Phillips, you old git, you shouldn't be playing them, or you're too old. And I used to love all that. You know, the banter's brilliant, you know, it's great. Yeah. And I would always hopefully let, you know, coming on a pitch and scoring a goal do the talking. As I said earlier, you know, action for me speaks louder than words. So, you know, I come on at Bournemouth, we're drawing the game. I think it was either 0-0 or 1-1. And Nigel said, get yourself on and get a goal. And I was like, what? Yeah, it's just as simple as that, yeah. I'll just go on and get a goal. And I'd done it, you know, late on in my career, I spent a lot of time on the bench and coming on and scoring. And quite often I'd come on and get an important goal. And I went on and I get a ball crossed in from Anthony Knockhart from the right-hand side. And again, you know, being in the right place, as soon as it left its foot, I'm in the right position. I just thought, just get it on target, try and get it on target. And I've headed it. It's keeper scrambling across. And it was one of those, was it over the line? Was it not over the line? Bournemouth players are saying it wasn't. I could see it clearly was, but the linesman was that side and he had a lot of bodies and thankfully he gave the goal. So our supporters, you know, down at Bournemouth as you come out are in the far corner and I've sprinted over and skid on me lads on me. And as I've got up, I've given it the old Zimmer frame one back to the, and they loved it, they absolutely loved it. And, you know, things went a bit mental after that because of what I did. I just thought, well, I didn't think about doing it, it was just a spur of the moment. So it was... It was great.
It's good. I like that. Now, this is the unmissable one because you have helped a maverick in Jamie Vardy. Now, without betraying my sources, I've spoken to people who know him well and who've helped select him, who say that possibly he's a guy who needs blinkers and maybe doesn't feed on strategy and information and tactics. But undoubtedly, through playing with you and then being coached by you, I'd have to say that the difference between him as a championship player and then as a Premier League winning player, you can notice that there's been an evolution. Just give us a word picture of the Mustang, the wild Mustang known as Jamie Vardy.
Difficult. He could be very, very difficult at times. Lunatic, enthusiastic.
Yeah.
He's a good lad.
What's the difficulty now? Is it about rawness of personality and he kind of sees everything as black or white, and I'm not listening.
That was one of the biggest things for me when I played obviously with Jamie, but as soon as I stepped onto that coaching side, you know, one of the biggest things I always and I found difficult just for my own personal coaching career was, you know, when I'm talking to someone whether they're listening or not, and at times I thought, are you listening, Jamie, or not? Are you listening? But I think he gives that perception of. No, because he won't look at you, he'll be looking at, you know, he's quite hyperactive, he's very hyper, so he'll be looking at, as if, I used to beat myself up thinking, he's not listening to me, but over time, because I used to talk to him about the Jimmy Greaves, because he was very much crash, bang, wallop, smashed everything, and in training I used to say, Jamie, you've got, try and pass it in the net, yeah, and I think over time, it took such a long time for it to register, now I might be wrong, but I just, when I started watching his finishing in the Premier League campaign, you know, the goals he scored where he started bending them in, if he got one-on-one, he wouldn't smash it down the middle, he would just slot it past the keeper. Now, whether that's the information that I try to give him, that we all try to give him, I think he's not as daft as you see him. He's not stupid. I think he actually took on board what we were trying to do, but he takes it on board in a different way.
Two things come out of that from my point of view, and again, smack it down if it's rubbish, that every process of educating is a two-way thing. So in having a difficult-ish pupil, he's taught you as a teacher because you've had to assess, am I saying the right things? Is he not listening? Is any of this going in? Mm. And as soon as you reflect on any process of communication, you're presumably getting more aware, you're getting better. Yeah. So presumably that process has had an effect on you as a teacher.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it's been, like you say, a two-way thing. But I think also what's helped Jamie as well as, you know, Nugent, Ujoa, Okazaki, is, you know, I played with these guys for a few months as well. And I used to join in quite a lot in training. So not only are they learning from us having a discussion, they're also visually watching what I'm doing. Because I've only recently retired, so I've still got them instincts of what I'm doing finishing. And I'd quite often join in the training, and the lads would be like, give us a clap because I've done something well. So I think I think Jamie, Nuge and Joa and Okazaki were learning visually as well as learning.
Yeah, I get that. You know, I get that.
Talking to each other. So I think that kind of helped him as well.
And one of the messages would be that you can't expect as a teacher, as a coach, I use that word, no, not pejoratively, I think coaches are teachers, that learning won't be instant.
Oh, yeah.
That it's an investment, and that the frustration you feel about maybe somebody's manner or when you see them not applying what you've taught them instantly, that may not mean that it's not working.
Yeah. Patience is massive. It is. And that's one of the biggest things I've learned in my coaching career. I used to get angry when I first started. Craig Shakespeare was brilliant to me. He said, listen, you've got your mannerisms, you're a calm guy. He said, don't let it affect you, your coaching. He said, because I can see it when I'm watching you, you're getting frustrated because what you're trying to tell them, they're not doing. He said, but you've got to be patient. And if it's still not working, what you have to do, the good coaches work out another way of trying to get them to learn. Now, whether that's me, I'm still able to demo something. So I'm able to show them exactly what to do, where some coaches, you know, perhaps not physically able to do it. He said, find other ways of trying to get the best out of them. He said, but don't get frustrated. Have patience with them.
Well, look, it's about that time of day now where I need to thank you for showing so much patience to us. This has been every bit as enjoyable and fulfilling as everybody told us it would be. We'd watched you, and the reason we asked to speak to you was that you'd given us an awful lot of enjoyment. And I think a lot of people don't talk about enjoyment as part of the process of what each of us does. Yeah. So thanks for an enormous amount of enjoyment during your career and just for stopping and spending so much time talking to us today.
It's just an absolute pleasure, and I have to say it's an honour to sit here talking to yourself, listen to you
Something's
many times
wrong.
That's
not right. Now, that
no,
can't
it
be
is,
right.
Honestly, listening to you talk about football and the passion that you have on TalkSport, I listen to that an awful lot when you come on with Alan. Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. It's been an enjoyable day.
And this, then, has been The Big Interview with Kevin Phillips. Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. Please go right now to patreon.com/GrahamHunter and become a socio, become a paying member, and get an extra big interview every month plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.